but they are, as we and her creator can see. So it's unlikely that her sexual issues will present themselves in terms of sexual organs and acts. Much more likely, they'll look like a bowl and some keys. Chapter 17. Accept Sex. Ever try to write a sex scene? No, seriously. Tell you what, go try. In the interest of good taste, I'll request that you limit yourself to members of the same species, and for clarity, that you limit yourself to a mere pair of participants, but aside from that, no restrictions. Let them do whatever you want. Then when you come back, in a day, in a week, in a month, you'll have found out what most writers already know. Describing two human beings engaging in the most intimate of shared acts is very nearly the least rewarding enterprise a writer can undertake. Don't feel bad. You never had a chance. What are your options? The possible circumstances that lead two people to sexual congress are virtually limitless, but the act itself? How many options do you have? You can describe the business clinically as if it were a do-it-yourself manual, insert tab A into slot B, but there are not that many tabs or slots, whether you use the Anglo-Saxon names or their Latinate alternatives. Frankly, there just isn't that much variety, with or without the ready whip. And besides, it's been written in the mass of pornography ad nauseam. You can opt for the softcore approach, describing parts and movements in a haze of breathy metaphors and heroic adverbs. He achingly stroked her quivering skiff as it rode the waves of her desire, etc. This second sort is hard to write without seeming A. quaint, B. squeamish, C. hugely embarrassed, D. inept. To tell the truth, most writing that deals directly with sex makes you wish for the good old days of the billowing curtain and the gently lapping waves. I honestly believe that if D.H. Lawrence could see the sorry state of sex scenes that developed within a generation of his death, he would retract Lady Chatterley's Lover. The truth is that most of the time when writers deal with sex, they avoid writing about the act itself. There are a lot of scenes that jump from the first button being undone to a post-coital cigarette, metaphorically that is, or that cut from the unbuttoning to another scene entirely. The further truth is that even when they write about sex, they're really writing about something else. Drives you crazy, doesn't it? When they're writing about other things, they really mean sex, and when they write about sex, they really mean something else. If they write about sex and mean strictly sex, we have a word for that. Pornography. In the Victorian age, sex was nearly impossible to find in polite literature, due to rigid censorship, both official and self-imposed. Not surprisingly, there was plenty of impolite literature. The era was unsurpassed in its production of pornography. Maybe it was that mountain of dirty writing that used up all the possibilities of writing about sex. Even in the modernist period, though, there were limits. Hemingway was restricted in his use of curse words. Joyce's Ulysses was censored, banned, and confiscated in both the United Kingdom and the United States, in part for its sexual references. Lots of sex thought, even if the only sex act shown in it is onanistic. Constance Chatterley and her lover Malors really broke ground in plainly shown and plain-spoken sex, although the novel's obscenity trial, effectively ending censorship in the United States, did not take place until 1959. Strangely, with less than a century of sexual writing as standard practice, there is almost nothing left but cliché. There's a very famous sex scene in John Fowle's French Lieutenant's Woman, 1969, between the two main characters, Charles and Sarah. In fact, it's the only sex scene in the novel, which is odd, given the extent to which the novel is about love and sex. Our lovers enter her bedroom in a seedy hotel, he carrying her from the sitting room because she has sprained her ankle. He lays her on the bed and joins her amid frenetic shifting and removal of clothing, which, this book being set in Victorian times, is considerable. Soon, the deed is done, and he lies spent beside her, at which point the narrator points out that precisely 90 seconds have elapsed since he walked from her to look into the bedroom. In that time, He walked back, picked her up, carried her to the bed, fumbled and groped and consummated their love. Now, there are several possible constructions we can put on this particular description of the act of love. Perhaps Fowles wants to address, for reasons unknown, the shortcomings of Victorian males in the ardor department. Perhaps he wants to ridicule his poor hero. Perhaps he wants to make some point about male sexual inadequacy or the fallibility of desire. Perhaps he wants to accentuate the comic or ironic incongruity between the brevity of the sexual act and its consequences. Of the first of these, why bother? Besides, he admits in a famous essay on the crafting of the novel that he really has no knowledge of 19th century lovemaking, and in depicting sex between a Victorian man and woman, what he's really writing is science fiction. Of the second, it seems needlessly cruel, particularly when we've recently seen Charles in the arms of a young prostitute, where, rather than making love, he vomits into a pillow. Must he always be beset with performance issues? Of the third, 60,000 words seems rather a lot with which to surround a tiny treatise on male sexuality. Of the fourth possibility, we know that incongruities, comic or otherwise, fascinate the novelist. Let's consider another possibility, though. Charles has traveled from Lyme Regis in the southwest to London, where he has met with his future father-in-law, Mr. Freeman. Charles is horrified at the ill-judged marriage he has brought upon himself, complete with an offer of a job in business, anathema to a Victorian gentleman. He sees that he does not love the woman he is engaged to, nor the conformity which she and her father, as members of the rising middle class, covet. He seems to be on a tether between the poles of his restricted future with Mr. Freeman and the horrors of a life in commerce at one end in London and his fiancée, Ernestina, at the other in Lyme Regis. Charles has come back through Exeter, where the seedy hotel is located, in full panic flight. Sarah, the fallen woman, although we find out she probably is not, represents both the forbidden fruit, always tempting, and the way out of the marital disaster that he envisions awaiting him. His fascination with Sarah, which has been building throughout the novel, is a fascination with the unconventional aspects of himself, as well as with the possibilities of freedom and individual autonomy she represents. Sarah is the future, the 20th century, for which Charles may not be ready. He carries not a woman, but an entire constellation of possibilities into the bedroom. What chance does his sexual performance have? For the most part, even our sexiest writing doesn't have all that much sex in it. Okay, except Henry Miller's novels, which really do have that much sex in them, and it's pretty much about the sex. But even with Miller, the sex is on one level symbolic action, claiming for the individual freedom from convention and for the writer freedom from censorship. He's celebrating the removal of restrictions and writing hot sex. But look at Miller's sometime pal, Lawrence Durrell. What is it about people named Lawrence and sex anyway? His Alexandria Quartet, the novels Justine, Balthazar, Mount Olive, and Clea, 1957-60, is chiefly about the forces of politics and history and the impossibility of the individual escaping those forces, although it registers in readers' minds as heavily slanted toward the sexual. A lot of sex talk, of reports of sex, and of scenes taking place immediately before or immediately after sex. I would maintain this is not from trepidation on the writer's part. It's hard to find any evidence of Durrell being inhibited about much of anything, but from his sense that in novels so overheated by passion, the sexiest thing he can do is show everything but the lovemaking itself. Moreover, the sex that occurs is invariably tied up with something else. Cover for espionage, personal sacrifice, psychological neediness, desire for power over someone else. He presents virtually no sexual encounters that can be described as healthy, robust meetings of lovers. Sex in Alexandria is really pretty creepy when all's said and done. And it's all done. Two of the most notorious novels of that same period of the late 1950s and early 1960s Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, 1962, and Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, 1958, are famous for bad sex. Not bad as in unsatisfactory, bad as in evil. The protagonist of Burgess's novel is a 15-year-old leader of a gang whose specialties are theft with violence, violence without theft, and rape, to which he refers as the old in-out, in-out. The rapes we see do, in fact, take place in the narrative, but they are strangely distanced from us. For one thing, as many potential readers already know, Alex narrates in a patois he calls Nadsat, a mix of English and slang words, many of them of Slavic origin. The effect of this linguistic mode is to describe things in such alien ways that the acts themselves seem alien as well. For another thing, Alex is so interested in his own delight at stage managing the violence and rape, and in the terror and cries of the victims, that he almost neglects the sexual particulars. His most straightforward narration of a sexual scene is when he picks up two prepubescent girls. Even then, he's more interested in their cries of pain and outrage than in the activity occasioning them. Beyond that, Burgess is interested in depravity, not prurience. He's writing a novel of ideas, with an attractive slash revolting main character. So his chief concern is not to make the sex and violence interesting, but to make Alex sufficiently revolting. And he succeeds admirably. Some would say too well. Lolita is a slightly different case. Nabokov has to make his middle-aged protagonist, Humbert Humbert, depraved, certainly. But part of the revulsion we feel at his interest in his underage stepdaughter Lolita lies in the way our sympathy is co-opted by this monster narrating the story. He's so charming we are nearly taken in, but then he reminds us what he is doing to this young girl and we're outraged again. Nabokov being Nabokov, though, there's a kind of gotcha in it. We're disgusted by Humbert, but sufficiently fascinated to keep reading. The sex, then, like the narrative, is a kind of linguistic philosophical game that ensnares us and implicates us in the crimes we would officially denounce. Nor is there that much sex in the novel. Only a small amount of pederasty is even remotely tolerable. Much of the novel's notoriety, actually, beyond the fact that it has any pederasty, lies in its XXX imitators. The word Lolita almost immediately became a staple in titles of a certain kind of pornographic film. Teenage Lolitas, wanton teenage Lolitas, really wanton teenage Lolitas, titles like that. Really original, dirty movie titles. There, presumably, the sex is strictly about sex. What's that? You think it's just a guy thing? Definitely not. Juna Barnes, a contemporary of Lawrence and Joyce, investigates the world of sexual desire, fulfillment, and frustration in her dark classic Nightwood, 1937. The poet Mina Loy could have made T.S. Eliot faint. Modern women writers, as diverse as Anais Nin, Doris Lessing, Joyce Carol Oates, Iris Murdoch, and Edna O'Brien, ever since have investigated ways of writing about sex. I suspect O'Brien holds the distinction of having more books banned in Ireland than any other Irish novelist. Sex in her books nearly always takes on a political cast, as characters explore their sexuality while at the same time throwing off the restrictions of a conservative, repressed religious society. O'Brien's writing about sex is really writing about liberation, or sometimes the failure of liberation. It's religious or political or artistic subversion. The queen of sexual subversiveness, though, must be the late Angela Carter. Like O'Brien, Carter can write a very convincing sex scene. And also like her, she almost never lets it be only about sex. Carter nearly always intends to upset the patriarchal apple cart. To call her writing women's liberation is to largely miss her point. Carter attempts to discover paths by which women can attain the standing in the world that male-dominated society has largely denied them. And in doing so, she would liberate all of us, men and women alike. In her world, sex can be wildly disruptive. In her last novel, Wise Children, When the main character and narrator, Dora Chance, engages in sex, the aim is usually self-expression or exertion of control over her life. As a woman and a minor entertainer, she has comparatively little control, and as an illegitimate orphan whose father refuses to recognize her and her twin, Nora, she has even less. Taking some form of control once in a while, therefore, becomes all the more essential. She borrows Nora's boyfriend for her sexual initiation. He's none the wiser. Later, she makes love to the boy of her dreams at a party during which her father's mansion burns to cinders. And finally, as a septuagenarian, she makes love to her 100-year-old uncle, again while a very considerable shock is being delivered to her father, who is her uncle's twin. I'm not sure I can decode all the things that scene means, but I'm pretty sure it is not primarily about sex. Or aesthetics. If nothing else, it is a radical assertion of the life force. It can also be attacked from almost every angle on the psychological and sexual political compasses. Also, right after their lovemaking, her uncle makes his twin nieces mothers for the first time, presenting them with orphaned twins, grandnephew and niece. In Carter's experience, human parthenogenesis remains somewhere in the future, so sex is still required to produce babies, even symbolically. Now here's the thing about that. You're going to figure it out. You don't need me to tell you that this scene involving sex among the very old means something. Moreover, your guess is as good as mine when it comes to what it means, maybe better. The image of these two elderly people making violent, the downstairs chandelier sways alarmingly, love in the bed of their father/brother is so rich with possibilities that you almost can't go wrong. And perhaps no one can extract all its possibilities. So, go for it. That's generally true. You just know that these scenes mean something more than what's going on in them. It's true in life as well, where sex can be pleasure, sacrifice, submission, rebellion, resignation, supplication, domination, enlightenment, the whole works. Just the other day, a student mentioned a sex scene in a novel. "What's up with that?" she asked. "It has to be about something else. It's just so weird and creepy that it has to be about something else. Does it mean?" And then she told us exactly what it meant. All I could add was that it's not only true of weird sex. Sometimes even good literary sex is about something else. Oh, right. You can't really write about modern literary sex and skip over it, can you? Here's the thing. Lawrence didn't approve of strong language in private life and was almost prudish in some ways on the subject of promiscuity. Yet very near the end of his life, only in his early 40s and dying of tuberculosis, he pens this outrageously frank, open novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, about love and sex between members of two very different classes, between a peer's wife and her husband's gamekeeper. A man who uses all the Anglo-Saxon words for body parts and functions. Lawrence knows he won't write many more novels. He's coughing up his lungs, and he's pouring his life into this dirty story that's so far beyond anything he's already written and had censored that he knows, even if he pretends not to, that this thing will never have a wide readership in his lifetime. So, now it's my turn. What's up with that? Chapter 18. If She Comes Up, It's Baptism. Quick question. I'm walking down the road and suddenly I fall into a pond. What happens?
You drown.
Thanks for the vote of confidence. Or you don't. That pretty much covers it. Now what does it mean? Does it really mean anything either way? I mean, if you drown, you drown. If you get out, maybe all it means is you can swim. Fair enough. For a character in a novel, though, the case is different. What does it mean if he drowns or if he doesn't? Have you ever noticed how often literary characters get wet? Some drown, some merely get drenched, and some bob to the surface. What difference does it make? First of all, let's take care of the obvious. You can fall into the water in an instant, from a bridge that gives way, for instance, or you can be pushed, pulled, dragged, tripped, or tipped over. All of which have their own meanings, of course, and can be taken quite literally. Beyond that, drowning or not, has profound plot implications, as do the means by which a character does or doesn't drown. Consider just for a moment that a disconcertingly large number of writers meet their ends in water. Virginia Woolf, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Anne Quinn, Theodore Retke, John Berryman, Hart Crane. Some walked in, some jumped, others swam out and didn't come back. Shelley's boat capsized and Frankenstein's author became a very young widow. Iris Murdoch, who drowns enough characters that it seems like a hobby, herself nearly drowned in the sea fairly late in her career. Young Sam Clemens, years away from being Mark Twain, repeatedly had to be fetched out of the Mississippi. So maybe on some level, tossing characters into the river is A. wish fulfillment, B. exorcism of primal fear, C. exploration of the possible, and not just D. a handy solution to messy plot difficulties. But back to our soggy character. Is he rescued? Does he swim out? Grab a piece of driftwood? Rise up and walk? Each of those would imply something different on the symbolic level. For instance, rescue might suggest passivity, good fortune, indebtedness. The piece of driftwood raises issues of luck and coincidence, serendipity rather than planning. Remember the situation that begins Judith Guest's Ordinary People, 1976? Most likely. If you're over a certain age, you probably saw the film in a theater. Almost everyone did, evidently. And if you're under a certain age, you had it assigned at least in high school English. So you know the deal. Two brothers go out sailing on Lake Michigan, a storm comes up, and one of them drowns, and one doesn't. Now the story works because it's the older, stronger son, the swimming star and apple of his mother's eye, the one who never dies except in family tragedies and war stories, who perishes. The younger one, Conrad, the one who would never survive, survives. And he's tortured by his success at living, to the point where he tries to kill himself. Why? He can't be alive. It's impossible. His brother was stronger and didn't make it. So weakling Conrad has to be dead too. Except he's not. And what he has to learn, through his sessions with the psychiatrist, is that he was stronger. He may not have been the athlete his brother was, but in the moment of crisis, he had the tenacity or luck to hang on to the boat and not be swept away. And now, he'll just have to learn to live with it. This learning to live business turns out to be hard, since everyone, from the swimming coach to kids at school to his mother, seems to feel that he's the wrong one to still be here. At this point, you're probably saying, yeah, he's alive. So? Exactly. So he's not just alive. He's alive all over again. Not only should he have died out in that storm, we can say that in a sense he did die, that the Conrad we meet in the book is not the same Conrad we would have met before the storm. And I don't just mean in terms of Heraclitus, that you can't step into the same river twice, although that's part of it. Heraclitus, who lived around 500 BC, composed a number of adages, what are called his apothegms of change, all of which tell us that everything is changing at every moment, that the movement of time causes ceaseless change in the cosmos. The most famous of these sayings is that one cannot step into the same river twice. He uses a river to suggest the constantly shifting nature of time. All the little bits and pieces that were floating by a moment ago are somewhere else now, and floating at different rates from each other. But that's not really what I have in mind here about Conrad. True, when he is rescued from the lake and steps back into the stream of his life, everything has shifted and changed, but there's a more violent change in the universe where he's concerned. Which is what? He's reborn. See this in symbolic terms. A young man sails away from his known world, dies out of one existence, and comes back a new person, hence is reborn. Symbolically, that's the same pattern we see in baptism, death and rebirth through the medium of water. He's thrown into the water where his old identity dies with his older brother. The self who bobs to the surface and clings to the sailboat is a new being. He goes out an insecure, awkward younger brother and comes back an only child, facing a world that knows him as that kid brother, as his old self. The swimming coach can't stop reminding him how much better his brother was. His mother can't relate to him without the filter of his brother. Only the shrink and his father can really deal with him as himself. The shrink, because he never knew the brother, and his father, because he just can. Moreover, it's not just everyone else who has a problem. Conrad himself can't really understand his new position in the world, since he's lost some key elements to placing himself in it. And here's the thing he discovers. Being born is painful, and that goes whether you're born or reborn. Not every character gets to survive the water. Often, they don't want to. Louise Erdrich's Wonderful Love Medicine, 1986, may just be the wettest book ever set on dry land. At the end of the novel, Lipsha Morrissey, who's as close to a protagonist as the novel comes, observes that once, all the northern prairie was an ocean, and we realize that we've been watching the drama play out over the remnants of that sea. His mother, June, walks across the snow of an Easter blizzard like water and dies. His uncle, Nestor Cashpaw, has repeated thoughts of swimming to the bottom of Lake Machaminito and staying there, an image conflating death and escape. The scene I want to talk about, though, involves Henry Lamartine Jr. and the river. Henry Jr. is a Vietnam veteran suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. He seems to come out of it a little when his brother Lyman damages their prized car, a red Chevrolet convertible almost beyond repair. Repair it, Henry does, though, and when he's all finished, they go on a picnic by the flooded river. They seem to be having a great time, talking and laughing and drinking beer, when Henry Jr. suddenly runs out into the middle of the roiling, flooded stream. He says, rather simply, that his boots are filling with water, and then he's gone. When Lyman realizes he can't save his brother, he feels that in dying, Henry has purchased Lyman's share of the car, so he starts it and rolls it down into the stream to be with Henry. The scene is part personal tragedy, part Viking funeral, part Chippewa trip to the next world. All strange. What does the scene mean? I've been insisting that in novels, things are rarely as simple as they seem on the surface. Henry Jr. doesn't just drown. If that's what it were about, Erdrich would simply have him fall in and hit his head on a rock or something. He elects to go in, thereby choosing not only his relation to the world around him, but his manner of leaving it. In a sense, Henry has been drowning in life since he came back from the war. He can't adjust, can't form relationships, can't leave his nightmares behind. In a manner of speaking, he's already lost, and the issue for the novelist is how to have him physically depart the scene. There are a lot of deaths in Erdrich's novels that are suicides or, at best, what a British coroner would call death by misadventure. If we take a straight sociological or daytime talk showological view, we have to say it's terrible how hopeless and depressed their lives are. Which is true, of course, but I don't think that's the point. The characters' deaths are a form of choosing, of exerting control in a society that has taken control from them. Henry Jr. decides how he's going to leave this world, and in so doing, offers a symbolic action. He's swept away in the flood. So there are literary drownings like Henry Jr.'s and near-drowning baptisms like Conrad's, but a character's baptism can also be less harrowing. In the wonderful Song of Solomon, Toni Morrison has Milkman Dead get wet three times. First, he steps into a small stream while searching for gold in a cave. Then, he's given a bath by Sweet, the woman he meets on his trip into his past, and then he swims with Sweet in the river. So he gets wet three times. There's a religious or ritual association here. It resembles baptism in some sects, where the believer is immersed thrice, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Of course, it is worth noting that Milkman is not inevitably more religious, or at least not in any conventional sense, but he's clearly changed. Nicer, more considerate, less of a sexist pig. More responsible, more grown up. High time, too, since he's 32. So what happens to make him a changed man? Yes, he gets wet. Now, his getting wet is different from Hagar's disastrous trip in the rain in that he enters bodies of water. Rain can be restorative and cleansing, so there's a certain overlap, but it generally lacks the specific baptismal associations of submersion. And Milkman does eventually go all the way in. But if characters reformed every time they got wet, no book would ever have rain. The thing about baptism is, you have to be ready to receive it. And what preps Milkman for this change is a steady process of divestiture. Literally. He leaves parts of his outer shell as he goes on this quest. His Chevrolet breaks down, his shoes give out, his suit is ruined, and his watch is stolen. All the things that mark him as a fine city fellow and his father's son, gone. That's his problem, see? He's no one on his own when he starts out. He's Macon Dead the Third, son and heir of Macon Dead the Second, and inheritor of all his worst tendencies. In order to become a new person, he has to lose all the outer remnants of his raiment, all the things he has acquired from being the son of his father. Then he's ready to become a new person, to undergo his baptismal immersion. The first time he goes into water, he steps into a little stream he's trying to cross, but since he's just starting out, the experience only begins to cleanse him. He's still after gold, and characters who seek gold aren't ready for change. Later, after much has happened to change him gradually, he is bathed by Sweet in a cleansing that is both literal and ritual. Of equal importance, he returns the favor and bathes her. Their intent clearly is not religious. If it were, religion would be far more popular than it is. But what the characters intend as erotic ritual can have spiritual implications in the novel. When Milkman swims in the river for his third immersion, though, he knows it's significant for him. He whoops, he hollers, he laughs at danger. He's a brand new person and he feels it, which is what dying and rebirth is all about. In her Beloved, Morrison makes even greater use of the symbolic implications of baptism and drowning. When Paul D. and the chain gang escape from the prison, they do so during a flood of biblical proportions by diving down under the mud below their cell doors and swimming as one being up through the muck and the mud, emerging into new lives. Later, chronologically, although it takes place previously in the narrative, when Beloved makes her appearance, she emerges from water. On this, more in a bit. When Sethi gives birth to Denver, she does so in a canoe, for heaven's sake, and on the Ohio River, no less. Now, that particular body of water is significant in the novel, separating as it does slaveholding Kentucky from abolitionist Ohio. Ohio may not be much more hospitable to black folks in other ways, but at least they aren't slaves there. So to enter the river on the south side and climb out on the north, or even to cross it, is to emerge from a kind of death into a new life. So, when writers baptize a character, they mean death, rebirth, new identity? Generally, yes. But we need to be a little careful here. Baptism can mean a host of things, of which rebirth is only one. Literal rebirth, surviving a deadly situation, is certainly a part of it. Just as symbolic rebirth is the point of the sacrament of baptism, in which taking the new believer completely underwater causes him to die out of his old self and to be reborn in his identity as a follower of Christ. It has always seemed to me that the whole business probably ties in with some cultural memory of Noah's flood, of the whole world drowning, and then this small remnant being set down on dry land, cleansed of the sin and pollution that had marked human life right before the flood. Seen this way, baptism is a sort of reenactment on a very small scale of that drowning and restoration of life. Of course, I'm not a biblical scholar and may therefore be miles off base. Still, it's certainly true that baptism is itself a symbolic act, and that there's nothing inherent in the act that makes a person more religious or causes God to take notice. It's not as if this is an activity universally practiced among the world's religions, or even among the big three Western religions. So in a literary work, does submersion in water always signify baptism? Well, it isn't always anything. Always and never aren't good words in literary studies. Take rebirth. Does it represent baptism? If you mean, is it spiritual, then we can say, sometimes. Sometimes, though, it may just signify birth, a new start, largely stripped of spiritual significance. Let's take my old standby, D.H. Lawrence. In a passage of Joyce's Ulysses, Leopold Bloom thinks of Shakespeare that he has a quote for every day of the year. He could have added that Lawrence has a symbolic situation for all those days. In The Horse Dealer's Daughter, 1922, he has a young woman, Mabel, nearly drown, rescued at the last moment by the local doctor. Her family horse farm has been sold off after her father's death, and although she's been little more than a drudge in the family structure, she can't bear to leave and go to the only place, a manor house, that will take her in. So she cleans the gravestone of her long-dead mother, clearly indicating her intent to join Mom, and walks into the nearby pond. When young Dr. Ferguson sees her go under, he races in to save her, nearly dying in the process as she pulls both of them under. He manages with some difficulty to get her above water again, to carry her to safety and generally to care for her, which is clearly a first for both of them. Here's where things get messy, though. The doctor brings her forth from her watery bed. She is coated, not with clean water, but with slimy, smelly, rather disgusting fluid. When she awakens, she has been cleaned up and wrapped in a blanket, under which she's as naked as, well, the day she was born. In fact, it is the day she is born, or reborn. And if you're going to be born, you may need a doctor in attendance, although he usually doesn't have to dive in with you, to the relief of mothers everywhere. And there's going to be all that amniotic fluid and afterbirth. And after that, cleaning and a receiving blanket and the whole bit. So what does she do with this brand new life of hers? Tell young Ferguson, I love you. A thought which has never occurred to either of them until this moment. And his reborn self thinks it's a satisfactory idea, even though he's never found her attractive until this moment. But she's a brand new person, and so is he, and these new selves find something in each other the old ones, limited by their associations with the rest of her family, couldn't possibly find. Is it spiritual? That probably depends on what you think about possessing a brand new self. It's not overtly religious. On the other hand, almost nothing happens in Lawrence that doesn't seem to me to be deeply spiritual, even if it's in fairly mystifying ways. So, when a character drowns, what does that mean? Oh, they die. Remember me mentioning Iris Murdoch earlier? Given half the chance, she'd drown the Seventh Fleet. If there's water in one of her novels, somebody's going to drown. In The Unicorn, 1963, she has a character nearly drown in a bog in order to have a cosmic vision and then be saved, only to have the vision fade before it can do him any good. Later, she has two characters drown in separate but related incidents, or at least one drown and the other fall over a cliff by the sea. And Flannery O'Connor, along the same lines only more peculiar, has a story called The River, 1955, in which a little boy, having watched baptisms joining people to God on a Sunday, goes back to the river the next day to join God on his own. Yes, he does, sad to say. And Jane Hamilton, in A Map of the World, 1994, has her main character allow a child to drown through negligence. Then she has to deal with the consequences throughout the remainder of the novel. Not to mention John Updike's Rabbit Run, 1960. In which Rabbit Angstrom's wife, Janice, drunkenly drowns their child while trying to bathe it. Each of these instances is particular. It's a little like Tolstoy says at the beginning of Anna Karenina about families. All happy families are the same, but every unhappy one has its own story. The rebirths slash baptisms have a lot of common threads, but every drowning is serving its own purpose. Character revelation, thematic development of violence or failure or guilt, plot complication or denouement. To return to Morrison's character Beloved, rising from the water, back from the dead. On the personal level, the river may be the Styx, the river of the dead in the Greek underworld that the spirits crossed to enter Hades, and it certainly functions that way, She has returned from the dead, literally. But the river stands for something else as well. In its small way, it is the Middle Passage, that watery sojourn that, one way and another, took the lives of millions, as Morrison says in the novel's epigraph. Beloved has died when her mother kills her, rather than allow her to be taken back across the river into slavery. The drowning imagery is not merely personal here, but cultural and racial. Not every writer can pull that one off, but Morrison can. Like baptism, drowning has plenty to tell us in a story. So when your character goes underwater, you have to hold your breath. Just, you know, till you see her come back up. Chapter 19. Geography Matters. Let's go on vacation. You say okay, and then ask your first question, which is, who's paying? Which month? Can we get time off? No, none of those. Where? That's the one. Mountains or beaches, St. Paul or St. Croix, canoeing or sailing, the Mall of America or the National Mall. You know you have to ask because otherwise I might take you to some little trout stream 27 miles from a dirt road when you really want to watch the sun go down from a white sand beach. Writers have to ask that question too, so we readers should consider its implications. In a sense, every story or poem is a vacation, and every writer has to ask every time, where is this one taking place? For some, it's not that tough. William Faulkner often said he set the majority of his work on his little postage stamp of ground, his fictional Yaknapatawpha County, Mississippi. After a few novels, he knew that ground so intimately, he didn't even have to think about it anymore. Thomas Hardy did the same thing with his mythic Wessex, the southwest corner of England, Devon and Dorset and Wiltshire. And we feel that those novels and stories couldn't be set anywhere but where they are, that those characters couldn't say the things they say if they were uprooted and planted in, say, Minnesota or Scotland. They'd say different things and perform different acts. Most writers, though, are less tied to one place than Faulkner or Hardy, so they have to give it some thought. And we readers have to give their decision some thought as well. What does it mean to the novel that its landscape is high or low, steep or shallow, flat or sunken? Why did this character die on a mountaintop, that one on the savannah? Why is this poem on the prairie? Why does Auden like limestone so much? What, in other words, does geography mean to a work of literature? Would everything be too much? Okay, not in every work, but frequently. In fact, more often than you think. Just think about the stories that really stay with you. Where would they be without geography? The Old Man and the Sea can only take place in the Caribbean, of course, but more particularly in and around Cuba. The place brings with it history, interaction between American and Cuban culture, corruption, poverty, fishing, and, of course, baseball. Any boy and any older man might, I guess, take a raft trip down a river. It could happen. But a boy, Huck Finn, and an older man, the escaped slave Jim, and their raft could only make the story we know as The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by being on that particular river, the Mississippi. Traveling through that particular landscape and those particular communities at a given moment in history. It matters when they reach Cairo and the Ohio empties into the big river. It matters when they reach the deep south because Jim is running away in the worst possible direction. The great threat to a slave was that he might be sold down the river, where things got progressively worse the farther south you went, and he's floating straight into the teeth of the monster. And that's geography? Sure. What else? I don't know. Economics? Politics? History? So what's geography then? I usually think of hills, creeks, deserts, beaches, degrees latitude, stuff like that. Precisely. Geography, hills, etc. Stuff. Economics, politics, history. Why didn't Napoleon conquer Russia? Geography. He ran into two forces he couldn't overcome, a ferocious Russian winter and a people whose toughness and tenacity in defending their homeland matched the merciless elements. And that savagery, like the weather, is a product of the place they come from. It takes a really tough people to overcome not merely one Russian winter, but hundreds of them. Anthony Burgess has a novel about the Russian winter defeating the French emperor, Napoleon Symphony, 1974, in which he brings to life, better than anyone, that geography and that weather, the vastness of it, the emptiness, the hostility to the invading and then retreating troops, the total absence of any possibility of comfort or safety or solace. So what's geography? Rivers, hills, valleys, buttes, steppes, glaciers, swamps, mountains, prairies, chasms, seas, islands, people. In poetry and fiction, it may be mostly people. Robert Frost routinely objected to being called a nature poet, since by his count, he only had three or four poems without a person in them. Literary geography is typically about humans inhabiting spaces, and at the same time, the spaces that inhabit humans. Who can say how much of us comes from our physical surroundings? Writers can, at least in their own works, for their own purposes. When Huck meets the Shepherdsons and the Grangerfords, or sees the Duke and the Dauphin tarred and feathered by the townspeople, he sees geography in action. Geography is setting, but it's also, or can be, psychology, attitude, finance, industry, anything that place can forge in the people who live there. Geography in literature can also be more. It can be revelatory of virtually any element in the work. Theme? Sure. Symbol? No problem. Plot? Without a doubt. In Edgar Allan Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher, the narrator spends the opening pages describing a landscape and a day as bleak as any in literature. We want to get to the titular house, of course, to meet the last appalling members of the Usher clan, but Poe doesn't want us there before he's prepared us. He treats us to a singularly dreary tract of country, to a few rank sedges and white trunks of decayed trees, to the precipitous brink of a black and lurid tarn, so that we're ready for the bleak walls of the house, with its vacant eye-like windows and its barely perceptible fissure zigzagging its way down the wall right down to the sullen waters of the tarn. Never perhaps have landscape and architecture and weather, it's a particularly dingy afternoon, merged as neatly with mood and tone to set a story in motion. We are nervous and dismayed by this description even before anything has happened. So, of course, when things do begin happening, when we meet Roderick Usher, one of the creepiest characters to ever grace the pages of a story, he can't give us the creeps because we already have them. But he sure can make them worse, and he does. Actually, the scariest thing Poe could do to us is to put a perfectly normal human specimen in that setting, where no one could remain safe. And that's one thing landscape and place, geography, can do for a story. Geography can also define or even develop character. Take the case of two contemporary novels. In Barbara Kingsolver's Bean Trees, 1988, the main character and narrator reaches late adolescence in rural Kentucky and realizes she has no options in that world. That condition is more than social. It grows out of the land. Living is hard in tobacco country, where the soil yields poor crops and hardly anyone makes much of a go of things, where the horizon is always short, blocked by mountains. The narrator feels her figurative horizons are also circumscribed by what seem like local certainties, early pregnancy, and an unsatisfactory marriage to a man who will probably die young. She decides to get away, driving a 1955 Volkswagen to Tucson. On her way, she changes her name from Marietta, or Missy, to Taylor Greer. As you know by now, there's rebirth when there's a renaming, right? Out west, she meets new people, encounters a completely alien but inviting landscape, becomes the de facto mother of a 3-year-old Native American girl she calls Turtle, and finds herself involved in the shelter movement for Central American refugees. She wouldn't have done any of these things in claustrophobic old Pittman, Kentucky. What she discovers in the West are big horizons, clear air, brilliant sunshine, and open possibilities. She goes, in other words, from a closed to an open environment, and she seizes the opportunities for growth and development. Another character in another novel might find the heat oppressive, the sun destructive, and space vacant, but she wouldn't be Taylor Greer. In Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, Milkman Dead grows up without ever learning who he really is until he leaves his Michigan home and travels back to the family home country in eastern Pennsylvania and Virginia. In the hills and hollows, not unlike the ones Taylor Greer must flee to breathe, he finds a sense of roots, a sense of responsibility and justice, a capacity for atonement, and a generosity of spirit he never knew before. He loses nearly everything of his associated with the modern world in the process. Chevrolet, fine clothes, watch, shoes, but they prove to be the currency with which he buys his real worth. At one point, direct contact with the earth, he's sitting on the ground and leaning back against a tree, provides him with an intuition that saves his life. He responds just in time to ward off a murderous attack. He could have done none of those things had he stayed in his familiar geography. Only by leaving home and traveling to his real home can he find his real self. It's not too much to say, I think, that geography can be character. Take Tim O'Brien's Vietnam masterpiece, Going After Cacciato. The main character, Paul Berlin, admits that the American soldiers don't really know the land, don't understand what they're up against. And it's a forbidding place, dry or wet, but always hot, full of microbe-filled water and leeches the size of snakes, rice paddies and mountains and shell craters, and tunnels. The tunnels turn the land itself into the enemy, since the land hides the Viet Cong fighters only to deliver them virtually anywhere, producing surprise attacks and sudden death. The resulting terror gives the land a face of menace in the minds of the young Americans. When one of their number is killed by a sniper, they order the destruction of the nearby village, then sit on a hill and watch as shell after shell, alternating high explosives and incendiary white phosphorus, pulverize the village. A cockroach couldn't survive. Why do they do it? It isn't a military target, only a village. Did the bullet come from the village? Not exactly, although the shooter was either a VC villager or a soldier sheltered by the village. Is he still there? No. The place is deserted when they look for revenge. You could make the claim that they go after the community of people who housed the enemy, and certainly there's an element of that. But the real target is the physical village, as place, as center of mystery and threat, as alien environment, as generic home of potential enemies and uncertain friends. The squad pours its fear and anger at the land into this one small representative piece of it. If they can't overcome the larger geography, they can at least express their rage against the smaller. Geography can also, and frequently does, play quite a specific plot role in a literary work. In E.M. Forster's early novels, English tourists find ways of making mischief, usually unwittingly, and not always comically, when they travel to the Mediterranean. In A Room with a View, 1908, for instance, Lucy Honeychurch travels to Florence, where she sheds much of her racially inherited stiffness while losing her heart to George Emerson, the free-thinking son of an elderly radical. She finds what looks like scandal only to ultimately discover freedom. And a big part of that freedom stems from the passionate, fiery nature of the Italian city. Much of the comedy in the novel grows out of Lucy's battle to reconcile what she knows is right with what she feels to be right for her. Nor is she alone in her struggles. Most of the other characters stumble into awkwardness of one sort or another. Forster's later masterpiece, A Passage to India, focuses on other types of mayhem growing from English misbehavior as the rulers of India and from very confused feelings that beset recent arrivals on the subcontinent. Even our best intentions, he seems to suggest, can have disastrous consequences in an alien environment. Half a century after Forster's lightweight comedies of folly in Italy, Lawrence Durrell reveals an entire culture of libertines and spies in his beautiful tetralogy, The Alexandria Quartet. His Northern European characters, displaced to Egypt, exhibit every sort of kink, sexual and otherwise, from the old sailor with a glass eye and a predilection for young boys, to the incestuous Ludwig and Liza purse warden, to nearly everyone's inability to be faithful to spouse or lover. Darley, the narrator of the first and fourth volumes, tells us that there are at least five genders, although he leaves specifying them to our imaginations, in Alexandria, then shows them to us at full throttle. One might suppose that the heat of an Egyptian summer would induce some lassitude in these already overheated northerners, but there's little evidence of that. Evidently, an Englishman released from perpetual rain and fog is nearly unstoppable. What separates the sexual behavior of Forster's characters from that of Durrell's, aside from time, is D.H. Lawrence. His works, culminating in the overwrought and infamous, if not always successful, Lady Chatterley's Lover, opened the way for more sexual directness. Like many modern writers, he sent his characters south in search of trouble, but curiously, that trouble was not typically sexual, since he, being quite advanced, could get his people in sexual trouble right in the midst of inhibited Britain. Instead, when his travelers find sunshine in the south, they also encounter curious and sometimes dangerous political and philosophical ideas. Crypto-fascism in Australia, in Kangaroo, 1923. Psychosexual male bonding in Aaron's Rod, 1922. The return of the old Mexican blood religion in The Plumed Serpent, 1926. Desire and power in his little novella, The Woman Who Rode Away, 1928. What Lawrence does, really, is employ geography as a metaphor for the psyche. When his characters go south, they are really digging deep into their subconscious, delving into that region of darkest fears and desires. Maybe it takes a kid from a mining town in Nottinghamshire, which Lawrence was, to recognize the allure of the sunny south. Of course, this is not exclusive to Lawrence. Thomas Mann, a German, sends his elderly writer to Venice to die in Death in Venice, 1912, but not before discovering a nasty streak of pederasty and narcissism in himself. Joseph Conrad, England's greatest Polish writer, sends his characters into Hearts of Darkness, as he calls one tale of a trip into Africa, to discover the darkness in their own hearts. In Lord Jim, 1900, the main character has his romantic dreams shattered during his first experience in the Indian Ocean and is symbolically buried in Southeast Asia until he rises, redeemed through love and belief in himself, only to be killed. In Heart of Darkness, 1899, the narrator, Marlowe, travels up the Congo River and observes the near-total disintegration of the European psyche in Kurtz, who has been in country so long that he has become unrecognizable. Okay, so here's the general rule. Whether it's Italy or Greece or Africa or Malaysia or Vietnam, when writers send characters south, it's so they can run amok. The effects can be tragic or comic, but they generally follow the same pattern. We might add, if we're being generous, that they run amok because they are having direct, raw encounters with the subconscious. Conrad's visionaries, Lawrence's searchers, Hemingway's hunters, Kerouac's hipsters, Paul Bowles' down-and-outers and seekers, Forster's tourists, Durrell's libertines, all head south in more senses than one. But do they fall under the influence of warmer climes? Or do those welcoming latitudes express something that's already been trying to make its way out? The answer to that question is as variable as the writer and the reader. Now, most of this has had to do with fairly specific places, but types of places also come into play. Theodore Retke has a wonderful poem, In Praise of Prairie, 1941, about, well, prairies. Do you know how few poems there are of any quality about prairies? No, his isn't quite the only one. It's not a landscape that's inevitably viewed as poetic. Yet somehow, Retke, the greatest poet ever to come from Saginaw, Michigan, finds beauty in that perfectly horizontal surface where horizons run away from the eye and a drainage ditch is a chasm. Beyond this one poem, though, the experience of being a flatlander informs his work in obvious ways, as in his poems about this uniquely American